What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions like, why is no one talking about PNG's political refugee crisis?
I can't even call it an election. It was something like a criminal tug war.
Join me, Scott Whitey, as I chat all things Pacific politics on Polytalk.
Search up Polytalk in your favorite podcast app to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. And coming up in the program, 50 £500 bombs dredged from the bottom of Tuvalu's Nanumea Lagoon by a team from Operation Render Safe. A leading union official in Solomon Islands lays the blame for widespread absenteeism in the government service on lousy pay. And Fiji's head coach Mick Potter still hopeful that the Faino brothers will line up for the Batty at the Rugby League World Cup.
If they've got Fijian blood, I think it's right that they should play, but getting evidence from back then is a little bit hard at the moment, and it'll just go on someone who was living there and that vouches that her grandmother was born in Fiji.
More on the Faino Brothers World Cup quest and the search for evidence of their grandmother being born in Fiji later in the programme. I'm Richard Ewart, and Pacific Beach is produced on the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. First this morning, Pacific Islands Forum foreign ministers meeting in Fiji have failed to reach agreement on a joint statement criticising China's actions after their controversial ballistic missile test last month. The nuclear-capable missile carrying a dummy warhead was launched from a nuclear-powered submarine and travelled roughly 7,300 kilometres over several Pacific nations before landing in waters close to Tuvalu's exclusive economic zone. The stumbling block to a Pacific consensus on the region's response to China's actions is widely believed to have been objections from Nauru, formerly Nauru, and Kiribati, with New Zealand's Foreign Minister Winston Peters claiming both nations were acting under Chinese influence. Pacific Beat's reporter in Fiji, Lithe Mavono, watched the foreign ministers' meeting play out and joins us now. Lithe, good morning.
Good morning, and Yandaravinaka to you, Richard.
So the scene was set. Australia and New Zealand were intent on pushing for the Pacific Islands Forum to make the region's opposition to China's missile test very clear after consensus could not be reached in the immediate aftermath last month. So what went wrong?
Well, what happened, Richard, is that as Winston Peters put it to New Zealand media at the very end of the day, people had come into that meeting, or rather ministers from Pacific countries had come into that meeting with predetermined decisions or predetermined positions, is how he put it. So by the end of the day, which didn't take place until about 9 o'clock that evening, Richard, Secretary General Baron Wanga and the chair of the forum, foreign ministers meeting, Rick Honupuela, said nothing at all about the Chinese missile test and about the statement until pressed by Fijian media, after which they said that there was going to be more work done to it and put a timeline of the Pacific Islands Forum leaders meeting, which takes place in Palau next month. While being pressed, though, and while being asked to speak to allegations that the ABC had heard that there was blocks or effort to block the issuing of a statement by Nauru and Kiribati, Baron Wanga said that there was no actual blocking. He said he continued to speak about the Pacific way and the way that Pacific leaders work in consensus. But when pressed further, he said that actually the forum had put back to the working group the opportunity to work on that missile test response. But he made no mention of China specifically, which was quite interesting, Richard, but multiple sources from foreign island nations who were at the same meeting said that Kiribati was very specific in its effort to block consensus at the statement. And Richard, at the Pacific Islands Forum, particularly in its ministerial meetings, no decisions are taken without consensus. Even if it's only one country or two countries, which is in the case last Friday, if there isn't unanimous decision, there is no action taken on it. Both Nauru and Kiribati have developed close ties with Beijing in recent years.
And that's the crux of the matter, isn't it? Certainly from Winston Peters' perspective, New Zealand's foreign minister, I mean, he's pointing the finger at China, suggesting that they put pressure on those two small nations to block a consensus. Would that be a fair interpretation of what he's saying?
That would be, Richard, but it's important to note that he doesn't, you know, speak to Nauru and Kiribati by name. Neither does he actually mention China, but he comes very close to it. And he, I think the words that he used was that insiders, and he reminds everyone that that is us who have lived for thousands of years in the Pacific, cannot be influenced by the wishes of outside partners. And he said, and he alluded to these two countries being doing the work and the wishes of their outside partners. He said the Pacific needed to make a decision and a position, rather, and they needed to make that point very clear. And one thing that we understand and learn from Winston Peters is that neither Kiribati nor Nauru actually give reasons for their disagreement or for their blocking of these particular lines in the statement. But an official from one foreign nation speaking to the ABC privately went further and said that Kiribati's position was absurd and accused it of even lecturing ministers about consensus, reminding them about how decisions are made in the forum while ignoring the sentiment in the room. But Richard, what is clear is that there were definitely two camps, those who didn't want a statement issued against the Chinese missile testing and those who wanted for the forum to take a strong decision on the matter and speak on it.
So what about other reactions from other ministers who presumably went to the meeting expecting some sort of statement to be issued? I mean, it's now more than a month since this happened. It's beginning to look increasingly irrelevant, isn't it?
We did put that to Secretary General Baron Wanga and asked for, you know, an idea of how the meeting went on and asked for a temperature check and, you know, what the tension was like in the room. But he declined to speak to the positions of other countries. But the ABC has been told that Foreign Minister Penny Wong had pressed the meeting to issue a joint statement telling her colleagues from across the region that they needed to display leadership on the issue. But it was a closed session, so it was very difficult to speak to anyone else. And Richard, that meeting finished really late. No other minister from other Pacific countries spoke. But in a written statement, Wong said there'd been a clear and powerful discussion about the responsibility that Pacific members have to safeguard peace and stability and security in the region, considering especially the adoption of Prime Minister Sitiveni Rambuka's Ocean of Peace concept, which interestingly, this treaty between Australia and Fiji signed a couple of months ago is named for. And she said the Pacific leaders, the majority of Pacific leaders had spoken loudly, alluding to individual statements issued by the different countries immediately after the missile test. And she said that there was clear concerns over the test from spoken about in the room and clear concerns around sovereignty, transparency and notification. But Richard, it's important to note that Tuvalu's foreign minister basically announced just before the start of the meeting that Tuvalu is now speaking directly to China. They don't initially have a very close diplomatic relations because Tuvalu is one of three countries in the region that has a diplomatic relationship with Taiwan. But now they're asking Chinese support to locate the missile. But in a radio interview with me before the meeting, Wong said she hoped that outside parties would take note of the response that the Pacific had already sent. Papua New Guinea's Foreign Minister Justin Tuchenko told New Zealand media that his country was not happy and that the test was not helping anyone in the region and that it was becoming negative rather than positive. PNG is a very close partners with China.
And a little more about Baron Wong, the Secretary General of the Forum Secretariat. He is, of course, former president of Nauru. As a former president of that country, was he put in an awkward position? Did he have anything to say?
He didn't have very much to say, Richard, and a couple of us in that press conference pressed him about it, both in his capacity as Secretary General to speak to the tension in the room and to speak to the difficulty coming to a statement. And we also asked him to speak as former president of Nauru, but he refused to discuss Nauru at all and even tried to stay away from speaking about Kiribati and initially had denied that there was tension. He initially denied that there were efforts to block until the more detailed information that had come to the ABC through sources who were in the room was put to him. Then he spoke at length about the Pacific Way and the need for consensus. And this was his answer when I pressed him about whether or not sticking to consensus was in effect risking the sovereignty of the region.
The forum is not a country, it's 18 countries. That the strength of our voice, the louder we speak, we must include all of them. So it's not that easy. I hope you will understand. But we are getting there. We it's still in the process.
So the matter continues, Lither. I guess we wait to see if they ever do reach some sort of consensus. But allied to this, aside from Chinese missile tests, there was some discussion, I believe, on Solomon Islands, Prime Minister Matthew Wallace's suggestion of a regional security deal. I mean, is that gaining more support? Is that likely to get up at some point in the future, do you think?
Richard, it's now officially on the table, submitted as a working paper, as a recommendation from the Solomon Islands, who are, you know, of course, now chairing the Pacific Islands Forum. So that's an important first step. And there was conversation in the room. Secretary General Baron Wanga says that each of the members of the forum present said that they would now need to go back to inspect the mechanism suggested by Solomon Islands. And it's important to discuss that if it does go through, this will completely change the way security is done in the region. In the past, Pacific countries have always operated on obligations and alliances rather than treaties. And treaties are important because they're, of course, regionally binding. And if there is a regional security mechanism that binds the Pacific, it will ensure that the Pacific has to work with each other and consult each other rather than regional partners. And Richard, it's important also to point out that the current Vo Vale Union or Ocean of Peace treaty, which Senator Wong says will now be tabled in the Australian Parliament very, very soon, does form that kind of architecture. Once both Fiji and Australia ratify that union, the wording in the Vo Vale Union or the Ocean of Peace Alliance gives both countries the opportunity to invite other countries in. And so it kind of mimics the spirit in which Matthew Wallace is suggesting regional security. But what we were told by the chair of the forum, Rick Honipuela, Solomon Islands foreign minister, is that he said that it was received well, that there were questions, but what the officials need to go back and actually discuss is the fact that some of what the treaty asks for already exists in some of the regional mechanisms. So, for example, in the work against drugs, there is some police and defense collaboration there. And he says there are other instruments like that that already exist. So now they need to go back to ensure there is no overlap. But Richard, these things will come up again very soon. And we understand that along with the statement on China and the missile test, and along with more discussions on this treaty, we will see other conversations from that foreign ministers meeting at Palau. And so, for example, we're also going to hear more about the regional peace and security action plan, which the foreign ministers meeting have now endorsed, needs to go to Palau at the leaders meeting. There's also a regional Pacific fisheries treaty, a leaders ocean statement, and some work around the rights of persons with disabilities. So Richard, Palau, which is happening in the next few weeks and which will be covered, of course, by the ABC, Stephen Jedgett, is going to be a very important leaders meeting to watch.
Thank you very much indeed, Lide, for an update on what to turn out to be a lively, if in the end, I guess, inconsequential, because they couldn't reach a consequence of that particular meeting, the Pacific Island Forum Foreign Ministers meeting in Fiji on Friday. And as Lide points out, there will be another meeting coming up in Palau. Palau, of course, one of the few allies that Taiwan has left in the world. So that could be an interesting dynamic when they're talking about Chinese missile tests. We move on to more news matters now and the legacy of the Second World War, because a team from Operation RenderSafe have retrieved more than 11 tons of World War II era munitions from the bottom of the Nanumea Lagoon in Tuvalu. RenderSafe is the multinational mission led by the Australian Defence Force, which for the last 17 years, in fact, has been dedicated to removing unexploded ordnance from across the Pacific. The Australian High Commission in Tuvalu says this latest haul includes a number of 100-pound bombs and almost 5,500-pounders. Lieutenant Commander Samuel Mayers is a mine warfare clearance diving officer and commander of HMAS Diamantina that made the trip to Tuvalu for the latest operation.
We looked at a whole bunch of historic information and we made the assumption that the vast majority of the explosives would be in the center of the lagoon. So what we do is we then focus our diving effort on that. So we had two diving teams out. They'd go out on site, that we'd give them a GPS position. They'd send their divers down utilizing a handheld sonar. It's called Artemis, very cool bit of kit. They'd hit the bottom, they'd swing around, and then they started swimming lanes up and down a 150 by 150 meter box. Now, whilst they're swimming that, they've got their sonar pinging and they're looking for anything that is, you know, conspicuous, maybe it looks like a bomb. If it looks like, smells like, you know, sounds like, chances are it is. Then they would go over, they would see it, they would identify it if it is or not, mark it on the sonar. So we have a GPS position, we have a, and take a photograph with it as well, and then come to the surface, tell the surface supervisor, and then they go back down and they continue on. So that then forms the main body of our diving phase, which was about, yeah, the probably a week and a half of the 2.5 week operation.
More than 11 tons of World War II munitions were found. What was identified sort of in this?
Right. So we had upwards of 80 items. And now there are items that range from boxes of small arms ammunition, so 50 caliber machine gun ammunition that's still in boxes. There were mortars, there were 100-pound bombs, right way up to 500-pound bombs. So we found about 40 to 50 500-pound bombs alone.
During World War II, the US military built a base on Funafuti. Can you just talk about maybe the historical aspect of that? Why are there more than 11 tons of World War II era munitions likely in the lagoon?
At the end of World War II, we had huge reserves of explosives ordnance within the Pacific theatre, and it really comes down to, you know, the economics of war. At the end of the war, it was cheaper to dispose of them at sea rather than ship these huge amounts of explosives back to the United States and the UK and other places. You know, you're talking about the transport fees and then the storage fees. And arguably, a lot of these munitions were developed relatively quickly throughout, you know, the late 30s and early 40s. So by the time the war had ended, and certainly the years thereafter, a lot of these things had become obsolete. It's sort of starting a war with an iPhone 5, and then by the end of it, you've got an iPhone 15. So do you hang on to the iPhone 5 or you chuck it in the bin? So at the time, it was seen as the best practice to dispose of it at sea.
With more than 11 tons of munitions down there, what sort of risk does this pose to either people in Tuvalu or the Tuvaluan environment?
Yeah, definitely. You know, all explosive remnants of war, you know, they should be treated seriously, and they are dangerous. They have been underwater for a long time, but they still present potential risk to people and vessels and certainly everyday life in and around the lagoon. Now, there is something to be said about it's been there for 8 years, and as you know, to let a sleeping dog lie, as long as it's not disturbed and as long as it's not moved or touched or messed with, they tend to be in a stable state. They'll remain there until we can get, or until a future disposal program is developed.
And tell me, you were working with some Solomon Islander partners as well. How are they working with your team?
Right, so the RSIPF, so the Royal Solomon Islands Police Force, EOD section in particular, Bomb Disposal Section, they are fantastic at what they do. They're probably one of the leaders in the Pacific. And the ADF has had presence and a partnership with them for many, many years. At the moment, we've got a clearance diver over there, and they're working with them to build that maritime EOD capability. So this was an opportunity to bring the RSIPF out and working with these munitions in these conditions, because they do it day in, day out. They really are subject matter experts on it. So we utilize them not in the diving aspect, but in the shallow water and the land reconnaissance aspect. And they're there effectively as sort of partner advisors, helping us and showing us what they do. Equally, we've got the opportunity then to show them how we do. So really, it's a tactical, it's sort of a TTP, a tactics and procedures exchange, so they can see sort of how we do it and we can benefit from how they do it.
The partnership with Tuvaluans on the ground, but particularly the Tuvalu Police Force, how did you guys work together on that?
Yeah, this was actually quite an emotional thing very shortly on. So on our arrival to Tuvalu, we met up with the police and and we met up with the captain of their ship, and, you know, he's a fantastic guy. It's interesting to see, like, our service in the Navy and how our life is very, very similar to theirs. You know, the problems we have is very, very similar to theirs. The gripes we have are very similar to theirs. The good days we have are very similar to theirs. So, you know, you sort of speak a universal language when you're Navy police. It was really cool to see. You know, we had a little bit of time alongside, so our people could meet their people and their counterparts could, you know, hear and share experience and sort of swap stories. And then, you know, over the 2 weeks that we're at sea, we're constantly on the radio, then we're constantly doing boat transfer with them. So at the end of the 2 weeks, it almost felt as though, you know, they were very much our mates, our brothers and sisters, and we'd, you know, leaving Tuvalu after being in the country for about a month. Yeah, it was a little bittersweet, but, you know, it's always exciting to think that, you know, we'll be back there whenever we are, and a country that size with a maritime police force that size, chances are we're going to bump into the same people again and rekindle and meet up again.
Lieutenant Commander Samuel Mayers from Operation Render Safe talking to Jordan Fennell about their successful mission to Tuvalu. Now, the Bougainville government says it will fulfil its people's desire for independence regardless of the outcome of a long-delayed vote in the Papua New Guinea Parliament. Both sides have agreed that the results of the 2019 Bougainville independence referendum will be tabled next month, with a vote on whether to accept or reject the outcome to be held at a later date. The referendum result was almost unanimous in favour of severing ties with Papua New Guinea, but under the terms of the Bougainville Peace Agreement, PNG's parliament effectively has the final say. However, even if a majority of MPs vote the referendum result down, Vice President Ezekiel Massat says Bougainville's push for independence will continue.
We'll cross that bridge when we get there. But our preparations on Bougainville is ongoing. The leaders, Bougainville Leaders Forum, has endorsed the final Bougainville position, which is self-government to be declared on the 1st of September 27. Between September 27 and 2030, we would be in a self-government phase, and then Bougainville will achieve full independence as a independent nation on the 1st of September 2030. In the event that the parliamentary vote is a no, in the event that the national government intends to call back Bougainville to come sit on the table to discuss something that, let me put it plainly, the Bougainville people have made the decision. So if the national parliament says no, Bougainville will need to consider its options and consider a response of whether to come back and sit on the table to renegotiate on something that the people had already made the decision in abundance. Whilst I might sound a bit angry, I'm not. I'm respecting the process. They can, national parliament can do as it pleases. But it is our view that there was a strategy on the national parliament and the national government's part to poison the ratification waters so that the ratification fails. And if that happens, then Bougainville has the mandate to then decide how to best implement the wishes of its people through a constitutionally guaranteed referendum.
Ezekiel Massat, spelling things out pretty clearly there, Vice President of Bougainville. Now let's take a look at one or two of the other stories that are making headlines in the Pacific on this Monday morning, or Sunday for you if you're on the other side of the dateline. Diana is with me. Good morning.
Good morning, Richard.
First of all, some sad news to report from Japan. Fijian rugby player Simone Bunalangi has apparently died of heat stroke after a training session.
Yeah, so Simone Bunalangi was only 26 when he was hospitalised last Monday after displaying symptoms of severe heat stroke. Now, Japan has been experiencing an intense heat wave in recent weeks, and his club, Kyushu KV, is based in the southwest of Japan, which reached about 35 degrees Celsius on Monday.
And Bunalangi, I believe it didn't get the chance to play for his new team.
No, so he did pass away on Friday in hospital, and he only joined Kyushu KV last month, having previously played with Tokyo Sun Goliath. Now, his club released a statement addressing Funilangi's passing, saying that the players, staff and all team associates are devastated by this sudden news.
Very sad, to say the least, and surprising, really, with a professional athlete, but no doubt there'll be more investigations to come. Now, back in Fiji itself, up to 5,000 Fiji National University students have been forced to drop out because basically they can't afford to stay there, right?
Basically, yeah. So FNU is facing a 10 million annual student debt crisis, according to the Fiji Times. This is compounded by the cost of living crisis, which is hitting students just as hard as everyone else, and was compounded when FNU increased the cost of their rooming fees at the start of last year, and they cited operational costs for the cause of that.
So we have a situation where large numbers of students have already bailed out, but the ones that are still there, they're struggling too, a lot of them, yes?
Yes, yeah. So apart from the 5,000 that have dropped out, 10,000 students are also just struggling with essential costs. So they're going hungry and are pretty much unable to pay transportation costs to and from classes in order to keep up with their university fees.
It's tough enough being at university sometimes. Students do actually work, I think.
Yes,
We can both vouch for that.
Absolutely.
You currently and me are a couple of weeks ago. Now, finally, to Solomon Islands, where a new official residence will be built for the Prime Minister.
Yeah, so the Minister of Infrastructure, Ricky Fuo, has announced that the project has entered its design phase, so it's getting started, and it's scheduled to be ready in time for Solomon Islands' 50th independence anniversary in 2028. The previous official residence, the Red House, had been announced for demolition back in 2016, so this one's been a long time coming. And as reported by In-Depth Solomons, Australia is understood to be funding the project, but no cost has been confirmed as of yet.
Right. Okay. Well, we'll keep an eye on that. No doubt there will be an official opening as and when the building is complete. Diana, thanks very much indeed for the update.
No worries. Thank you, Richard. Pacific
Beat. That's us, Pacific Beat, for a Monday morning here on ABC Radio Australia. Richard Hewitt sitting in for Aggie Tupou on this occasion. And the president of the Solomon Islands Council of Trade Unions, Tony Kagawai, is calling for an urgent review of the public service wage structure. His call comes in the light of findings released by the Auditor General, which suggest that absenteeism by government workers has cost the country nearly $1 billion. The AG wants the government to get tough on enforcing attendance laws. But Mr. Kagawai, who is also president of the National Union of Workers, says the root of the problem is that government staff are not being paid enough to live on.
We need to verify the claim that we lost so much million because of the issue of absenteeism. How can you go to work when you know there's not enough food on the table for the family, not floating school fees, medical, insurance, etc.? You either look for somewhere to fill up the gap because the payments in public service is a lousy payment. It does not mean living. They need to establish a living wage. The stakeholders here already carry out a survey. That's ADB, World Bank, Australian High Commission Office. They recommend $990 per week is the living wage. They strap it off and they just live with it for the last 2-3 years.
Are you saying that the Auditor General's office may have missed something here?
Yeah, he just called the figure of absenteeism. But he has to look at the reasons behind absenteeism. Because you cannot just absent for nothing. There have to be reasons behind. So what I'm saying, I do not dispute the figure he called, losing millions, but I'm saying that there are reasons for it. And the obvious reason is the pay package for civil servants is a lousy payment.
Tell me, the pay that you're talking about, is it very low for Solomon Islanders?
Yeah, yes, the current pay structure in public service is very low. It is below poverty line. You cannot meet your basic needs whatsoever. It is a cross-the-board issue. Again, the Prime Minister was making his position clear that he needs to restructure. It does not only affect the public sector, but it also affects the private sector. The legal minimum wage in the country is $8 per hour. It's very low, while the recommendations for a living wage is $990 per week for a family of six, husband, wife, and four dependent children. That's the recommendation in the past, a few years. They sit on the recommendation.
What would you like the government to do now? Because $1 billion is a lot of money to lose.
Yeah, I mean, that's how they look at it. They look at what just one aspect of it, the absenteeism issue. They do not look at the entirety. They should look at the whole why. Why do they absent? Are they lazy? Are there any reasons? So I'm trying to explain some of the reasons. What we know. We have been saying review the whole current wage structure. It's all below poverty line. Lift it up. Go by the recommendation of ADB and World Bank. They haven't complied to the recommendations. And here they are complaining about absenteeism. Absenteeism is just a fraction of the whole issue.
These low wages, what sort of impact is that having on workers and their families?
It means that they will leave their job and look elsewhere to cater for the other portions here in Honiara, especially in the urban areas. It's very expensive.
If there is an absenteeism issue, what are those workers doing in the meantime if they're not going to work?
I understand that some of them have to go and look for ways to make ends meet. One of the ways is they will go and sell betel nut or smoke on the street or fast cars or go and cook food and sell them the open market or go to the garden to plant products to sell in the market. So I'm not surprised there is too much absenteeism.
Tony Kagabai, President of the Solomon Islands Council of Trade Unions, with his thoughts on widespread absenteeism. He was speaking there to Caroline Tiraman.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Follows my every word, that guy. The search continues for a birth certificate or any other documentation that would open the way for the West Tigers Faino brothers to honour their grandmother and represent Fiji at the Rugby League World Cup in October. Now, the trio have Tongan, Maori and Fijian heritage, but they have declared for the Bati. And the International Rugby League has no problem with the brothers' request, provided they can produce some solid evidence to support their story.
Played quickly by Twal. Galvin, Stephen Arnold, ball around the corner, Sam Rutherfainu has gone over.
They could play for New Zealand or Tonga, but Sione, Latu and Samuela Faino want to play for Fiji. Their belief is that they qualify through Fijian ancestry on their grandmother's side, but the Bati's head coach Mick Potter says tracking down the documents they need is proving to be difficult.
The information I'm getting is they should, and they're very willing to get it over the line. And honestly, I don't know what's going to happen, but I'm very hopeful that these guys get to play for Fiji. And their grandmother is adamant about where she's from, where she was born. And unfortunately, with the elders being mostly passed away, it's hard to find the evidence. And back in the 50s, when she was born, the records are scant.
The brothers' story has generated plenty of chatter on social media and among the Rugby League podcasters.
The three Faino brothers have committed to Fiji for this World Cup. I can see them all starting for the Bati and having a massive impact.
They just add to the layer of quality that, you know, just lifts up the standard. They could play a key role in three players. That's a massive difference to your roster.
The chairman of the IRL, Troy Grant, says they have no issues with the brothers' application to represent Fiji, as it's evident they have a genuine desire to play for the Bati. However, the world governing body is playing it by the book, and having already extended their deadline, the Fainos and the FNRL need to come up with the required documents very soon. More broadly, though, the case reopens the debate about how many countries any one player should be allowed to represent.
Comes through Latu Fainu, who sees a huge hole. There he is, the fill-in man, the utility tonight.
Latu Fainu played for Tonga in 2023. Now he wants to play for Fiji, and he could also opt for New Zealand. Mick Potter says he has no problem with that.
Doesn't bother me either way. People jump on boats and they migrate, and it's a sort of mixed culture
everywhere, and I don't mind that people, you know, especially from smaller countries, can play for different nations, and it probably adds to the spice of rugby league.
But as the generations roll on, eventually the supply of heritage players available to play for Pacifica teams will dry up. That's why Mick Potter is keen to grow the game in Fiji. He wants younger players from the local competition to get better, faster, and put their hands up for Bati selection. He describes himself as Switzerland in the relationship between the Silktails and the FNRL, which remains fractious to say the least. The Silktails are producing young talent, though, and three of their current squad have just signed NRL deals with the Bulldogs.
I'm very neutral with that area, but all the pathways that we can get to with very competitive clubs in the NRL, I think, is very helpful. And Silktails is one of those pathways. Being able to go to Canterbury Banks now, I think that's second to none. The systems that got in place there under Cameron Seraldo and Phil Gould, I don't think there's any better. Really happy for the young men, and best of luck. Hopefully in a few years we see them in the Fiji Bati team.
Meanwhile, as far as the Faino brothers are concerned, the search for that proof they need goes on.
If they've got Fijian blood, I think it's right that they should play. But getting evidence from back then, the forensics seem to be a little bit hard at the moment, and it'll just go on someone who was living there and that vouches that her grandmother was born in Fiji.
Times since I heard the high diddle diddle used in a rugby league commentary. Nice to hear it there. Good luck to the Faino brothers. Let's hope they can track down the documentation they need, because they're clearly very, very keen to represent Fiji in honour of their grandmother at the Rugby League World Cup.
Discover the stories that shape our region on Culture Compass. Travel across the Pacific with Afmasanga Sayuli Salamasina von Reiki as she traces the shift from oral traditions to online connections and explores the delicate balance between conservation and cultural practice across the islands. Culture Compass, a journey through resilience, revival and deep connection. Tuesdays at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Very good morning to you. It's Pacific Beat here on ABC Radio Australia, and less than a year to go now before Tahiti plays host to the Pacific Games for the third time. First time round in 1971, there were 14 participating nations and 17 sports. Then 24 years later, in 1995, only 12 nations but 25 sports. Next year, the programme will feature 24 sports and 24 competing nations. So with 4,500 athletes expected, and a similar number of volunteers required to keep the event on track, how are the preparations going? The executive board of the Pacific Games Council are just back from a series of high-level meetings in Tahiti. We're joined now by the council's chief executive, Andrew Minogue. Andrew, good morning. Welcome to Pacific Beat.
Thank you, and good morning, Richard.
So what did you learn from the trip to Tahiti? Are things basically on track for next year?
I think we did learn that. In fact, we had representatives of all 24 participating countries join the executive board there for our general assembly. We got lots of reports from the various areas of preparation for the games next year, and we all learnt and appreciated the fact that Tahiti is well on track to delivering an excellent games for us all next year.
The lead up to an event of this nature always seems to come with some little issue, though, and I gather possibly the swimming pool is a bit tricky for Tahiti. Is that correct?
Always, there always does seem to be something, not just in the Pacific Games, but any games around the world. It's such a big task to put an event of this magnitude on, and the inevitable challenges. We've resolved matters in terms of the swimming pool. We had some discussions 3 months ago in May when we were there last as a board with the French Polynesian president and the various stakeholders. And at that point, we worked through some issues with the pool and were able to confirm that a new 50-metre compliant with World Aquatic Standards competition pool will be built. That was reinforced last week during our meetings over in Tahiti, and plans are now afoot for those pools to be installed in time for the games next year.
Yes, you're right to point out it happens to other events too. I recall before the Manchester Commonwealth Games, there were rumours that the swimming pool was a few centimetres short, which would have been a big problem. Now, Tahiti, of course, will be the focus of the games, the island of Tahiti, but the games will also take place, some of the events, on some of the other French Polynesian islands. So they're spreading it around the nation as best they can, essentially.
They are. In fact, Tahiti itself is quite a big island, and some of the competitions are going to be a fair distance from the main town of Papeete. So there's a lot of work going on for the transport planning to make sure the athletes can get to those venues quickly and efficiently. Then, as you said, the outer islands, we've got Moorea, which is about a 45-50 minute ferry ride from Papeete, is going to be hosting some road events. And we also have the island of Raiatea, which is a flight, not very far, but it is nevertheless a flight of around an hour, a little bit less, from Tahiti, which will be hosting shooting.
Now, you've had meetings, I believe, with the President, President Brotherson, and also with the French High Commission Secretary General. Yes. Can you tell us what occurred in those meetings?
Yes, certainly. So obviously, as a territory, an overseas territory of France, the French government are very much invested in making sure that the games in French Polynesia are successful. So as a good example, with the swimming pool, the French state is funding 50% of that project in conjunction with the French Polynesian government. So we always make sure to include the French state in our meetings and in our communications, and they've been a great support with President Brotherson and his new Minister for Sport, Vanina Pommier. We had a series of meetings with them over the course of the week, and they just continue to reinforce the support that their government has for delivering the games. Of course, they are responsible for the infrastructure of the games facilities and making sure they're provided on time, as well as the financial support to the games organising committee. And we're very pleased with the fact that that is all happening smoothly and things are on track with the government's support for the games.
When it comes to the opening ceremony, I recall New Caledonia 2011, the games were opened by the French president. Is the current president likely to be there next year?
Well, we did ask that question. Now, the French elections for the new president, because President Macron is term limited, and that will happen next May. So we open our games on July 24. At that point, there'll be a new president of France who will have been in office for only, I guess, a couple of months. So we've put on the table that we'd love to have that person there, if possible. But we understand that the timing of that may not work. But they did assure us that there'll be very high-level representation from France for the Games, as there was in 2011.
And with or without the French president, clearly it would be great to have him or her present. But going back to New Caledonia 2011, the opening ceremony, you will recall, I'm sure, that there were criticisms of it being too French. And with the majority of the athletes speaking English, they were struggling with a lot of it. So I assume there were lessons learned that year.
Oh, I guess so. I think we're all evolving in terms of how we communicate in our languages across the Pacific. And I can assure you and everybody listening to the program that the organisation of these games has, and the organising committee led by Nolene Parker and Steve Rowell, the president and the CEO, are very committed to delivering services in English. Throughout the week, they spoke to us and their staff spoke to us in English. They're very capably bilingual, as is New Caledonia as a territory, but they are really, really making extra efforts this time around to make sure that we can all understand what's being conveyed for the games. And I really want to commend the work that they're doing in that area.
Just a final point on the number of athletes who will be attending. If 4,500 is the figure we're looking at, that's around 500 fewer than Honiara. Is that that's still too big in the eyes of the council?
I think we'll be happy if we're at 4,500. As you said, 5,000 for the last two games in Honiara 23 and Samoa 2019, it was too big. We'd like to get it down to 4,500. We think that is manageable. They're the size of the games that we had, for example, in Papua New Guinea in 2015 and some of the ones before. And we are on track to doing that through the reduction in some of the team sports and some quotas that we've now got in team sports where nations have to actually qualify to get to the Pacific Games.
Well, Andrew, thanks very much indeed for the update. Good to know that everything is on track for next year. A lot to look forward to. Thank you very much indeed for your time.
It's a pleasure, Richard. Thank you.
Andrew Minogue, CEO of the Pacific Games Council, and the Tahiti Games begin on July the 24th next year with the closing ceremony on August the 8th. And I reckon the new French president would do well to maybe take time out after the first 2 months of a new presidency and put in an appearance at the opening ceremony. We shall see. Pacific Beat. Before we go, quickly mention the first two results in the pool round of the OFC's Champions League soccer, of course, and Galaxy of Fiji walloped the host nation Club Rewa by 4-1, including a hat-trick by their Brazilian star man called Medina. He's on his 20th club, and he's not that old. Gets around, this guy. The other match saw PNG champions Lay City beating Tupapa Mararenga from Cook Islands by 4-1. At least Tupapa did score. That's their first goal for about 10 years in the OFC Champions League, so I guess they can take something out of that match. Two more matches to come today in the other pool, and they will feature Auckland City, the current champions, of course, looking to make it, I think, 5 or 6 championships in a row. We'll keep you posted. That's just about it from Pacific Beat for this morning. The afternoon show will be along at 5 past 5 PNG time this afternoon. And Aggie should be back in this chair tomorrow morning at 5 past 6 PNG time. Hope you can join her then. I'm Richard Ewart. Thanks for your company. Have a great day.